Let's go in our Bibles to Exodus. Book of Exodus, we're in chapter 10 this morning. Reading from chapter 10, verse 21, down through all of chapter 11. Exodus chapter 10, we'll begin in verse 21. The Bible says, "Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand toward heaven. There may be darkness over the land of Egypt, a darkness to be felt." So Moses stretched out his hand toward heaven, and there was pitch darkness in all the land of Egypt 3 days. They did not see one another, nor did anyone rise from his place for 3 days. But all the people of Israel had light where they lived. Then Pharaoh called Moses and said, "Go, serve this Yahweh, your God. Your little ones also may go with you. Only let your flocks and your herds remain behind." Moses said, "You must also let us have sacrifices and burnt offerings that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. Our livestock also must go with us, and not a hoof shall be left behind. For we must take of them to serve the Lord our God. We do not know with what we must serve the Lord until we arrive there." But the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he would not let them go. Then Pharaoh said to him, "Get away from me. Take care to never see my face again, for on the day you see my face, you shall die." Moses said, "As you say, I will not see your face again." Chapter 11, verse 1. The Lord said to Moses, and probably it's best to interpret it, the Lord had said to Moses, "Yet one plague more I will bring upon Pharaoh and upon Egypt. Afterward, he will let you go from here. When he lets you go, he will drive you away completely. Speak now in the hearing of the people that they ask, every man of his neighbor and every woman of her neighbor, for silver and gold jewelry." The Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. Moreover, the man Moses was very great in the land of Egypt, in the sight of Pharaoh's servants and in the sight of the people. So Moses said, "Thus says the Lord, about midnight I will go out in the midst of Egypt, and every firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sits on his throne, even to the firstborn of the slave girl who is behind the handmill, and all the firstborn of the cattle. There shall be a great cry throughout all the land of Egypt, such as there has never been, nor ever will be again. But not a dog shall growl against any of the people of Israel, either man or beast, that you may know that the Lord makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel. And all these your servants shall come down to me and bow down to me, saying, 'Get out, you and all the people who follow you.' And after that, I will go out." And he went out from Pharaoh in hot anger. And the Lord said to Moses, "Pharaoh will not listen to you, so that my wonders may be multiplied in the land of Egypt." Moses and Aaron did all these wonders before Pharaoh, and the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he did not let the people of Israel go out of his land. You know, as the end of this construction project draws close, it's amazing how one little piece can kind of throw off an entire schedule, can hold up the whole project from coming to completion. It's usually because something goes wrong, as in this situation. And often it's because of something stupid, again, as this situation. Just one piece of metal that needs to be fabricated 4 inches shorter than what it arrived. I remember when I was working for my boss in construction, we were doing a kitchen. I've told you the story before. And we got done to the very last day, the very last part of the project, the very last screw that needed to be turned in. I was under the cupboard. I was screwing it down, the countertop, and my boss and the homeowner were right above me as I'm putting in the last screw. And I squeezed that screw, and I gave it one extra just in case, and that little screw poked up right through the countertop, prolonging the whole project for another 2 weeks so that we could get another countertop in and replace that. Stupid. They're signing the paperwork. They're going over the whole project. The whole thing's done, and it's not done. When it comes to God's projects, He's never off. His plans are often long. They're often drawn out as we wait for them to be completed. But there's never anything that goes wrong
with God's projects. And certainly, it's never because of anything stupid that there's a delay. In fact, the slow workings of God reveal His wisdom. And before He brings His final judgment, He always issues a final call. We read it this morning as we began the service. As the book of Revelation is laying out the different judgments that are being peeled back and sounded forth and dumped down just before the last great onslaught of God's judgment, God sends an angel with an eternal gospel and says, there's one more chance. Before the angels sing around the throne, it is done. It is finished. There's one more chance. Before God turns up the heat forever and there's no turning back, there's one final call. That's what we want to look at this morning. As the clock ticks down, and it is ticking, we dare not afford to ignore God's final call. As Jesus comes to Jerusalem, the Sanhedrin and the Pharisees are asking Him for a sign. And Jesus says, you know how to read signs. You look at the clouds in the morning. If it's red, you know it's going to be a scary day. Or at night, you know it's going to be a good day the next morning. You know how to interpret the signs. I'm not going to give you a sign. As Jesus comes marching into Jerusalem, He sees the olive tree, or the fig tree. It's in full bloom. And He says, I'm coming. And He curses the fig tree because there's no figs on it. And then He says, Jerusalem, you should have known what time it was. You should have known the season. You should have known that things were near. As Jesus lays out things for us in the Bible, He says, listen, you're not going to know the day. You're not going to know the hour that I'm coming. But He gets upset when His people don't at least know which season it is. He gets upset with them when they look like they're ready, but they're really not. And as the clock is ticking, as we listen to the news, as we read the scriptures, as we read through what's happening in God's program, we would be foolish not to be thinking end of time, because time is running out. In fact, the Apostle Paul in the book of Romans says, our salvation is closer now than the day that we believed. And there is an aspect that every generation of Christians from the time of Christ has been looking for Jesus Christ to arrive on scene. But as events in the world continue to unfold, they're unfolding at an unprecedented rate. They're unfolding in an unprecedented universality. They're unfolding with unprecedented haste. The time is drawing short. Jesus says in Revelation, I am coming, and I'm coming quickly. And the time is running out. But before the time is run out, God issues a final call. As we look at this today, I want us to see two prominent features of God's final call, because we saw it there in chapter 11. The Lord said to Moses, or He had said to Moses, before He goes in and talks to Pharaoh, yet one more plague I'll bring upon Pharaoh, and then he'll let you go. This is it. This is my final call. There's two prominent aspects of God's final call. The first is this: God hits hardest where it hurts the most. We've seen it in the book of Revelation. We see it here in the book of Exodus. Back up in verse 21, the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand toward heaven, that there may be darkness over the land of Egypt, a darkness to be felt. There's some question as to what that last phrase, a darkness to be felt, means. Some have interpreted this to say that a darkness to be felt, it has the idea of carrying in a sandstorm that would darken the skies. And it would infiltrate all tents and homes and houses and temples. It would literally blacken the sky, and you could feel the darkness. That doesn't seem to have the supernatural impact that this text means. That it's something that happens, but it happens quite naturally. And it happens, though not frequently, relatively frequently. But the effect that it has upon Pharaoh is that it utterly terrifies him in the process. This is a darkness that the other way to translate this, rather than a darkness to be felt, would be a darkness that requires one to grope, requires one to reach out and to feel his way through the darkness. And it's probably a play on words. Moses, stretch out your hands and call forth a darkness that requires a stretching out of the hands, and you'll call out this darkness it's so oppressive, it's so close, it's so claustrophobic, it's so enveloping that it requires people to grope their way through. As God gives this one more before the final judgment, as God gives this one last judgment here in number 9, he hits hardest where it hurts the most by hitting Egypt with their most influential god. Their chief god was the god Re, or Amun. Re, you may have heard before. He's the sun god. He's the god that, according to their belief, he created himself. He was self-created. He's the source of all life, of all being, of all everything. God starts his judgments with the Nile, the bringer of life, and he ratchets things up till he deals with their chief god, Amun-Re. I think when we think of darkness, and you look at some of the different plagues that have gone before this, you think, big deal. I mean, it's just darkness. How bad can that be? I mean, hail? That's horrible. Lice? Gross. Locusts? Wow. Okay. And at that point, Pharaoh says, get rid of this death from me. Okay, we can understand those are like plagues, but come on. Darkness? I mean, when I was a kid, I was afraid of the dark. Remember going up the stairs, backing my way up the stairs in a big old house, and my dad runs around to the front and rings the doorbell that's located right on the stairway, and screaming and running back downstairs and crying. I remember being a young man before we got married and living in my father-in-law's church, and after all the lights are turned out and everyone's gone home, playing the piano up front and hearing the footsteps up in the balcony and turning on every single light in the church as I make my way through, making sure nobody's in the church with me. I hate the dark, okay? But I don't think we have a proper appreciation of what it means to be terrified by darkness. Back in 1915, Ernest Shackleton brought some 20 men down with him to Antarctica. And as they neared Antarctica, they were trapped in an ice pack. And it was in January of that year that the ice crowded in around their boat and it refused to let them go. And from that point on, their adventure became not exploration, but survival. And for several months, it was just trying to stay alive. And by God's grace, all of them did. But listen to how he accounts this. The crew faced many hardships in the months that followed, including freezing temperatures, near starvation. But of all the frozen terrors they faced, none was more disheartening than the long polar night. Sailors grew uneasy as winter set in and the light began to fade. In early May, the sun vanished altogether, not to be seen again until late July. Shackleton's biographer writes, "In all the world, there's no desolation more complete than the polar night. It's a return to the ice age, no warmth, no life, no movement. Only those who've experienced it can fully appreciate what it means to be without the sun day after day, week after week. Few men accustomed to it can fight off its effects altogether. In fact, it's driven some men mad." Darkness. It's hard for us in this age of technology and backlit screens and everything that we have. Light just pervades our existence. And if we don't have enough of it, We buy a bigger. We buy a brighter. We turn on more. And we do it at the flip of a switch. We do it with such convenience, we don't even think about it. It's almost impossible for us living in this day and age to appreciate fully a plague of darkness. How ominously dark threatened the ancient people. We travel easily at night with the aid of various forms of electric lighting, but they were virtually immobilized in the darkness at night. We don't fear people ransacking us in the darkness, but the robbers would operate on the roadways at night. We don't think anything about all of these things. People abroad in the nighttime were assumed to be criminals, and typically, in fact, they were. We can be active at night because our homes and places of work can be cheaply illumined. They closed up entire cities at night. They understood that the darkness was essentially chaotic, a kind of enemy of all that is safe and good. For us, we just simply think of the darkness as another phase of any old day. And they did too, until the whole day brought no light. Until a whole other day brought no light. So it couldn't have been just an eclipse. And then another day, and there's no light. I don't know if you've ever been in an arid place where the sunshine is banked on. When we were down in Ironwood this summer, out in the middle of the Mojave Desert, where they get the less than 1 inch of rain per year. Well, we went on Saturday and did our laundry. It started to rain. We all ran outside with our cameras and started taking pictures of the rain. And we brought it back and we started to show the pictures of the rain. It's like, yeah, it's rain. But you don't get it. I was sending pictures to my wife of clouds. Big deal, mountains and clouds. But you don't get it. There's never clouds. There's never rain. And for the Egyptians, the steadfastness, the faithfulness of the sunshine in their climate, in the middle of the Sahara Desert, okay, except for the Nile River, the steadiness of the sunshine is something that's banked upon. It's something that they worship because they felt that all of their life was held together by the same one who could bring forth the sun with such steadiness, day after day after day after day after day. The sun god was their chief god. It had the idea of the God's face shining upon us as a people. And suddenly, it's dark. It's gone. And God hits them where they feel it the most. Insecurity. Worse than that, terror. Absolute terror was reigning at this moment. Pharaoh was especially hit by this because Pharaoh was believed to be an incarnation of the sun god. All of Egypt is looking to first Pharaoh and then to this god of the skies who marched across the heavens every day to bring them some source of steadiness, some source of faithfulness, some source of order in the midst of their confusion. And all they had was confusion, and this confusion brought nothing less than terror. And we see there, verse 24, so Moses calls, Pharaoh calls Moses. Moses, you got to get over here. Get over to the palace. Grope your way here. I don't care how you get here. Get over here. And then he says, go, serve the Lord. Your little ones also can go with you. Just let your flocks and herds remain behind. Moses, go, do whatever it takes to get us out of this situation in which we find ourselves. Give us our light back. Let the gods shine on us again. God hit not just the whole nation of Egypt where it hurts, But God hit Pharaoh in particular where it hurts. Pharaoh's being hit right between the eyes with the one things that he's holding more precious than anything else in life. The possession that he gets to hold on to and refuses to let go. That is control. And as God starts to take control out of the hands of Pharaoh, he does it in a very unique way. He starts to hit him right between the eyes. And we see that this is one of Pharaoh's most relished possessions, because it's revealed in the way that he tries to manipulate and compromise his way into blessing again. Verse 24, go serve the Lord. Your little ones also can go with you. Just let your flocks and your herds remain behind. Back up in verses 8 through 11, Moses had said, We will go. We will go with our men, our women, and our children. Remember what Pharaoh says back up there? Look at verse 11. Verse 10, but he said to them, the Lord will have to be with you if ever I let you go, along with your little ones. No way. All of a sudden, God turns out the lights. Turning out the lights so that he can reveal to him that he is the only God. So that the light can go on in Pharaoh's mind that there is a God, and it's not my son God. It's the God of the Hebrews. It's the God who is. My God's been snuffed out into oblivion. Okay, Moses, God must be with you. You can take your little ones. Just leave your flocks behind. You see what Moses says there in verse 26. Our livestock must go with us. Not one hoof shall be left behind. For we must take of them to serve the Lord our God, and we do not know with what we must serve the Lord until we arrive there. And that's true. God hadn't told them what sacrifices they were going to need. He's going to reveal that when we come to later on in Exodus, later on in Leviticus, and we're going to see how God creates this worship system for them. But at this point, they didn't know what it was that they were to worship God with. But it's interesting how Moses reiterates and emphasizes for Pharaoh, not one hoof will remain behind. Pharaoh, you're a man who is supposed to bring order to this whole region, to this whole nation. And as the superpower of the world, you hold the world at your feet. You say something, people respond, and you keep order around the globe. But Pharaoh, there's somebody who's in charge, and it's not you. Well, let's make a deal. I'll tell you what. I'll give you this. You just have to give me. Moses says, I don't have to give you anything. You're not getting the picture yet. When God calls out a people for his purposes, those who used to lay claim on him in the past no longer hold any claim. And as the story began, the people ran back to Pharaoh and said, your servants can't bear this. You're giving us requirements of the same quota without the same straw, the same provisions. We can't do this. Your servants. God is trying to tell Pharaoh, these people are in fact not your servants. They are my servants. They will serve me. And Pharaoh, you have no claim to anything concerning them. No manipulation, no compromise. And as we see the story continue, we see how deeply seated Pharaoh's absolute desire, thirst, lust for control is, because it's revealed in an anger that separates him from these people, distances them, and then threatens them. You see in verse 27, the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart and he would not let them go. So Pharaoh said, get away from me. Take care never to see my face again, for on the day that you see my face, you will die. Now we find in chapter 11 that they continue this same conversation. So we find out that the verses 1 through 3 are parenthetical, that God had told Moses this beforehand, just before Moses turns on his heel and walks out. But when God issues his final call, he has to hit us where it hurts the most. I wonder what that is I wonder what that is for us. You heard of people coming to the end of themselves and finally finding God. What a place to be. You remember when you finally came to the end of yourself and finally found God? How God knocked all the wheels off your wagon? How you couldn't go any further? God had to get you square in the face and say, listen, the way you're living, the thing you're trusting, what you're holding on to, what you refuse to let go of, it's not worth it. It's just so not worth it. Why don't you hold on to me? That's the invitation. That's the goodness of this God. As we move into chapter 11, we see that God works most where it appears least. He hits us hardest where it hurts the most. For Egypt, it was with their God, the source of their security. And for Pharaoh, it was his need to have control. Now, we see in chapter 11 that God works most where it appears the least. He's going to work in five different arenas. He reverses the will of those who are absolutely opposed to his purposes. Verse 1 of chapter 11, the Lord said to Moses, just one more plague, and I will bring Pharaoh, that I will bring upon Pharaoh, and afterwards he will let you go from here. In fact, when he lets you go, he will drive you away completely. God's working. God's working in the midst of this final call. And he says, Moses, you can be sure of this one thing. Pharaoh's going one direction, but in just a few moments, because of my hand upon him, he's going to be going the exact opposite direction. Not only will he let you go, he will force you to go. He will thrust you out. He will drive you away. Moses, you can bank on this, that as I am working, I'm reversing the will of the one who's opposed to me. It moves just a little bit farther. You come down to verse 2. Speak now in the hearing of the people that they ask every man of his neighbor and every woman of her neighbor for silver and gold jewelry. And the Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. In fact, the man Moses was very great in the land of Egypt in the sight of the Pharaoh's servants and in the sight of all the people. It has the idea that Moses, because of all that he was doing in the name of his God, had this larger-than-life impact upon an entire culture. And so if Moses told the people to ask, if Moses, the one who told you to do it, have not just my silver but my gold, and not just a little but as much as you want. It's interesting, as Moses is standing in front of Pharaoh, he says, we're going to go and we're going to bring our offering. And he says, no. You can go, but leave your stuff behind, your animals, your cattle. And God behind the scene is saying, Moses, not only are you going to take all your cattle, all your stuff, but you're going to take all their stuff too. Because as God is working, he's working a judgment, he's issued this final call, God will gain much glory from those who withhold their worship from God. This whole Egyptian culture is worshiping not the true God, but a pantheon of no gods. They're withholding any glory from God. And God says, guess what? I'm going to take all the stuff of their culture by which they are enriched. The stuff they hold on to and count themselves glorious. I'm going to take it and I'm going to use it. We're going to melt it down and I'm going to cover the posts. I'm going to cover the ringlets. I'm going to use it to adorn my temple. I'm going to spoil the Egyptians is the idea. He's going to use that phrase up in chapter 12. I am going to be victorious and I'm going to take all the pleasures and all the glories that were theirs and they have become mine. And I will receive glory through them. I'm reminded of Philippians chapter 2 when it says that one day every knee will bow and every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. Not only is God in the process of reversing the will of all who oppose, but he will receive glory and much glory from those who withhold it from him. We see that he's also granting favor to those once despised. In verses 4 down through 7, we see Moses says to Pharaoh now, "Thus says the Lord, at midnight, I'm going to go out in the midst of Egypt. And every firstborn of the land of Egypt shall die, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sits on the throne, the highest, even to the firstborn of the slave girl behind the handmill." The idea is that phrase is used in other Egyptian literature to mean the lowest of the low. The highest of the high to the lowest of the low will experience a reversal, a divine reversal by the hand of God. Even the firstborn of the slave girl who sits behind the handmill and the firstborn of the cattle, another Egyptian god, will be targeted here. "There shall be a great cry throughout all the land of Egypt, such as there's never been and never will be again. But not a dog will growl against any of the people of Israel, either man or beast, so that you can know that the Lord makes a distinction." As the book of Exodus begins to unfold, we see that the people of Israel are crying out. They're being beaten down. They're being scourged. They're being whipped. They're being abused. They're being treated as slaves. They're cutting out in the quarries for the Egyptian monuments. They're building cities and storehouses for the pharaohs. They're being used to drag these blocks through the sand with these cords over their back. They're building with bricks and mud. They're stomping these things and they're baking themselves and the bricks in the sun of the Sahara Desert. All these things are working on these slaves, and they cry out to their God. Here we have the same word being used, and God says, "The people of the people who are despised are granted favor in the eyes of the Egyptians. God is going to grant protection to those people that were once abused. The people that were suffering and crying and being whipped and tortured and used and abused, God says, you know what? When I bring my judgment, I'm going to hold my hand over them, and not even a dog is going to growl against them, let alone a death angel. Okay? But for you people who have abused, for you people who have refused, for you people who have despised, I'm going to turn your mirth, your laughter, your comfort, your ease, your pleasure, it's gone. And you will know the mourning and the suffering and the crying so poignantly that you've never experienced a pain like this before. You'll never experience it again. This is going to be unique because it's me at work. Look at what God says up in verse 1 of chapter 11. "Yet one more plague I will bring upon Pharaoh." And then verse 4, "About midnight," God says, "I will go out in the midst of Egypt, and every firstborn of the land shall die." It's I myself is the idea. I myself, the God who is the one who's going to be active. I'm not going to use an intermediary. I'm not going to use Moses to spread a hand. I'm not going to use a rod. It's going to be me, and I'm going to come at midnight. In the midst of this thick darkness that can be felt, and then the tide's going to be changed forever. The game's over as far as it's concerned. Then we see that God breaks the unions of those who are self-absorbed. Down in verse 8, Moses is standing in front of Pharaoh. Pharaoh has just said, "Get out of here. I never want to see you again. And next time I see you, you're dead." Moses says, "Fine, but before I go, you got to know this. The God that you're wrestling with, the God that you're standing against, the God that you're fighting, will give you no compromise. In fact, he will take the life of your firstborn. And not just yours, but everyone." And then he says, "Pharaoh, before I go, I want you to know this. Your servants who stand with you on that illustrious dais, on that palatial stand, right with you up on that throne platform. Pharaoh, the guys that pledge their allegiance and their loyalty to you, when God's done with you, they're going to get down off that platform and they're going to bow down in front of me and they're going to beg me to go. Pharaoh, you're going to be a man with a political action that nobody is going to support, including those most close to you. It's interesting when the book of Revelation unfolds, it talks about the beast, the false prophet, and the prostitute. And it talks about how this coalition that's activated by none other than Satan and demonically infused is coming together and working against God and his people. But as the end nears, we see that this coalition turns in against itself and it diffuses itself. In fact, it works against itself. God does that routinely. He works most where it appears least. So, okay, what does all of this mean for us? I understand God's final call. I think one of the things that we need to ask ourselves is, what is our inventory of our gods? We don't serve an Amun-Re. We don't serve the frog goddess, Ket. We don't have these funky-looking cattle gods and dog gods and frog gods. We don't do that. We know that. But their gods were the sources of all of their comfort, all their security, all of their blessing. Now, you got to ask yourself, and you got to ask yourself honestly, what is it that I turn to for my source of comfort when I'm hurting? What is it that I turn to as my security blanket? When everything hits the fan and everything's pulled out from underneath me, what do I have in my back pocket that I'm banking on to get me through the worst? What is it, not only my gods, but we have to ask ourselves, what is it that we refuse to let go? And for all of us, it's that aspect of control. It's that aspect of sovereignty. It's the desire of being God in our own lives. As God continues to work, he's working both in his people and he's working in those who don't yet belong to him. And he's putting his finger and he's touching, and it's a gracious touch. But he's forcing us to let go of our desire and our need to control. I struggle with this because I love to have things in order. And I think that if I can control it, then I'm secure. If I can control it, then I'm safe. If I can control it, then I'll be comfortable. I don't like letting go of control. And there's things that I hold on to and refuse to let go. And if I hold on to them too tightly, guess what God's going to do? He's going to take it away. And it's going to hurt more than it needs to when he finally gets a hold of it. Number three, I think we need to embrace the path of humiliation. If ever we're going to experience God's reversal, if ever we want to know what it is to gain favor and to have that position of responsibility, we have to know what it is to go down in the eyes of the world, to be despised, to suffer, to put myself last. Because there's coming a day, and it may be sooner than you think, that God is turning everything upside down. And so he says, listen, this is something you folks have to do. You must humble yourself in the eyes of the Lord so that he can exalt you in due time. It makes no sense except from a divine standpoint. Finally, I think that we need to be involved in the process of telling others. You watch the news, you see the global impact of a rise in the price of oil. You see a global impact of a theater shot down by Islamic terrorists. You see the global impact of lust and same-sex unions. You see the global impact of abortion and death on demand. You see that we're living in a culture that is fast-tracking itself into oblivion. There's only one hope, folks, and that hope is found in the light of the world, Jesus Christ. And how will they hear unless somebody tells them? And praise God, as we've seen just a week ago, God is still in the business of saving souls, but he uses us to tell them. Won't you be a part of God's final call? As the clock ticks down, and it's ticking, we cannot afford, even though we're not on the outside, most of us here today know Jesus Christ as Savior, but we can't afford to ignore God's final call, because each of us knows someone who's living yet in darkness. Let's pray.